Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Today, Bridget Griffin shared a video of her daily yoga routine, two self-help articles, and her new blog called Build Your Inner Bridge with Bridge. Girl, your sharing has turned into oversharing. No worries, Bridge. Geico has some info worth sharing with your 7 blog followers, like how you could save money on your car insurance, update your policy, and report a claim just by visiting geico.com. How's that for building your inner bridge? Bridge, Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon. You tell me.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, I went to a conference of childhood obesity researchers at USC where investigative science journalist Gary Taubes laid out a mountain of evidence pointing to carbohydrates causing the insulin secretion that puts on fat. Now, all these researchers there, they all nodded their heads. You couldn't help but nod your head because the evidence he presented was so strong. So after his talk, I went around, talked to some of these researchers and asked them, would they be changing their recommendations for these very fat children that they saw? No, not at all, they said. Of course they wouldn't, because their grants and careers were dependent on clinging to the myth that the low-fat, high-carb diet was the healthy one, and they were basically busy fattening up these already terribly fat children with this diet. Now, this is my own personal experience witnessing the horrifyingly bad science that has gone into what we eat, but Nina Teicholz has chronicled it in a masterwork, her book, The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. So stick with us as she guides us through the deception, careerism, and bad science and leads us to what is good science and a healthy diet. Hello, Nina.
Hello. Great to be on your show.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you. And I was talking to you before the show. Around 2008, I read this piece, this amazing piece you had written on saturated fat being healthy. And so, before your book, I'm an early fan.
That's so nice of you. That piece was in Men's Health magazine and was, for many years, the only piece of writing for the public that about why saturated fats might not be terrible for your health and, in fact, good for your health. And now there's a book out on it. And now I think other scientists are starting to come to the same conclusion, but it's been a long time.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that. And now, in the 1990s, you, like many of us, followed a low-fat diet as set forth by the USDA in the food pyramid. And then you, actually like me, discovered by accident that maybe this wasn't such smart advice. Now, tell us how that happened.
I had been a vegetarian all throughout my young adulthood and in college, and I had religiously, faithfully followed a low-fat diet, and I had always struggled with my weight. And it wasn't until I had a restaurant review column in the late 90s where they couldn't afford to pay for my meals, so they would just send me to the restaurant and I had to eat whatever the chef sent out to me. This was in New York City. The chef was not interested in sending out the kind of foods that I had always eaten, like stir-fried vegetables and chicken. Chefs are interested in sending out red meat, pate, foie gras, organ meat, all these foods that I had either never eaten or not eaten in decades, which I found delicious, but I also found that I was losing weight and my cholesterol indicators were all improving, and that was a huge mystery to me because it seemed contrary to everything that we had learned.
And actually, you write about how once these ideas about fat and cholesterol that actually were not based in good science, once they became adopted by all these official institutions, the government was telling us to eat this way, that even prominent experts in the field found it nearly impossible to challenge them, even with good science.
This is sort of the meat and heart of my book. I mean, not to, I guess, pun unintended, but there are, once the idea that saturated fat caused heart disease became institutionalized. So the American Heart Association adopted it, and that was the first anti-saturated fat guidelines in 1961. And once that happened, in institutions are, they're basically, like, institutional science is an oxymoron. Science, in order to work, it needs to question itself, doubt itself, constantly challenge its own premises. Institutions need to exert confidence, continuity. They're the opposite of good science. And basically, once something becomes institutionalized, the National Institutes of Health quickly adopted this hypothesis. In 1980, the USDA came out with its first low-fat, low-saturated fat guidelines, and they just, they couldn't reverse themselves because they were invested in this hypothesis. They administer all the research dollars. They appoint all the expert committees. It's the same small group of what I call nutrition aristocrats who run these places and these interlocking directorates. And protesters' voices, there were plenty of critics along the way, but their voices were really silenced. It became very hard to go up against the conventional wisdom and survive as a scientist in the field.
It's really terrible. It was like what I saw. I was so horrified. This was one of my novice experiences with, you know, the sort of university industrial complex, you know, putting out quote unquote science. And I mean, this really was horrible. Now, I want to get into the fat paradox, which is how you start out your book. And you write about in 1906, Stephenson, I don't know how to say his first name. Stephenson. You're good at this pronunciation thing. A Harvard-trained anthropologist, he was the son of Icelandic immigrants, and he moved to live with the Inuit in the Canadian Arctic. And talk about what he found out from what he observed about their diet.
So he went on four or five trips. He really lived with the Inuit in the Arctic, mainly in the Canadian Arctic, and he lived the way that they lived, ate what they ate, and he found that they ate a diet of 70 to 80% fat, and they in part of the year, they lived almost entirely off of caribou, and the other part of the year, they lived almost entirely off of seals. They occasionally in the springtime would pick some berries, but they ate almost no fruits and vegetables throughout the entire year. And he said, these are the healthiest people that I have ever seen. They were robust. They never got sick, even though they lived in very harsh environments. And for them, lean meat, what we think of as healthy meat, which was, you know, they when they had to resort to eating rabbits, they called it rabbit starvation because the meat was so lean without the fat that Stephenson, who was, you know, he was a respected man of science, and he wrote about this, and he was, he came back, he had correspondence with Harvard faculty members, and they thought he was amusing, but they never really took him seriously because the hypotheses, you know, the science was already taking off in a different direction, and he could just never gain any traction with his peers.
Now, they did an experiment where they ate this way, and actually they ate meat, but they first ate lean meat, and they did not feel very well, and then they started on fatty meat and felt much better, which is my own experience personally, too.
Right. Well, so this is a great story where he came back from the Arctic and nobody believed him. And so he, to prove that you could live on just meat and fat, he and a colleague checked, they had a team of scientists who oversaw them. They checked into Bellevue Hospital in New York City for an entire year. Well, the first few weeks they stayed at the hospital under strict supervision, and then they were allowed to, live in their own homes. But they were supervised the entire time, and they ate a diet of only meat and fat. And they said the only time that they felt ill or at all unwell was when they tried to, one of the researchers thought they should eat only leaner meat, and so they started getting diarrhea and all kinds of symptoms. And then when they fried up some brains and flesh and returned to their higher fat diet, they felt better. And at the end of the year, they were found to be in perfect health, and they hadn't gained any weight, and all their blood indicators looked great. I mean, one of the things that happens when now there's a whole movement to people who eat a lot of meat, eat only meat, but they don't understand that the meat has to come with the fat that accompanies it. And the fat is and without the fat, you are at risk of nitrogen poisoning. You need the fat to process nitrogen. So lean meat is not that healthy, and the Inuit knew this, and Stephenson learned this, and we're still learning it.
And remarkably, you write that Stephenson and his colleagues were expected to get scurvy without vitamin C, but they didn't, and perhaps cups, you say, because they included the bones and liver and brain, and they chewed bones for calcium like the Inuit did. So this is an important thing. We're not eating those. We get, you know, steak, but we're not eating liver anymore like we used to.
Right. In fact, the records of explorers, adventurers, missionaries, a lot of observation on of early tribes, human tribes, before they became, they started to import foreign foods, found that their traditions involved really eating first the organ meat, eating the liver, the kidney, the heart, and those are all much more nutrient dense. And including that if you eat fresh meat that hasn't been cooked, that's the source of vitamin C, so that people eating fresh meat don't get scurvy. And that's the same pattern that you see large carnivores, like lions, when they kill their prey, they eat the viscera. They eat the organ meat before they eat the muscle meat. The Inuit used to feed the tenderloin, what we think of as the great, celebrated, perfect part of the cow. They fed their tenderloin to the dogs.
I love that. I love that. And you point out that the Maasai eats similarly, and I'm pointing that out because, you know, people think, well, how healthy is this? And you write that they eat a lot of meat and blood and a lot of milk and butter fat, no veggies, you know, and you say that their weight and blood pressure were about 50% lower than that of their American counterparts.
So this was the work of a doctor named George Mann, who in the 1970s, he went to Tanzania, and he had heard about this tribe called the Maasai. They were warriors. They were hunter-gatherers. Their way of life was undisturbed, and they ate almost entirely, especially the men. The women had a little bit more of a varied diet. The men ate nothing. The warrior class ate nothing but blood, milk, and meat. That was their only diet. And man did fairly he took electrocardiographs on them. He measured their cholesterol. He did a whole medical workup of these men and found that their cholesterol levels were lower, their blood pressure was lower. They were in tremendously good health. And one of the really profound surprises for him was that also their health, none of these indicators worsened with age. You know, we assume, Westerners assume that your health gets worse as you get older. Your cholesterol rises, your blood pressure goes up. And George Mann found that this was not inevitably true, so that there must be something about the Western way of life that was causing us to get sicker as we aged. So
Oh, I was going to ask you, some people probably wonder whether, okay, the Maasai, you know, they don't have cars. They're chasing things more than we do. You know, do the researchers consider that? Do they look at that, you know, whether their lifestyle as much as their diet had something to do with this?
Right. So that's a good point. I mean, actually, George Mann's observations was that they, you know, the elders, for example, whose blood pressure and cholesterol were still low, were relatively sedentary. They were no longer hunting at all anymore, and they would just sit around most of the day. And also, the Maasai were compared to a nearby tribe that had a fairly similar lifestyle, also without cars, and they lived, down the road, or not too far away, but they had basically like a Dean Ornish diet, really high in vegetables, root vegetables, tubers, and there's a fascinating comparison of these two tribes that was done in the early part of the 20th century. The vegetarians looked so much less healthy. They had many more health elements, and they were less powerful. They measured their strength. They showed up for medical service, and most of them had to be dismissed because they couldn't do any physical labor. So in some ways, you know, this is just one study, but it does control for these lifestyle factors that we talk about and is very provocative.
Yeah, and I have to say, I just finished my book, Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say Fuck, which will be out June 3rd, just to promote my own book, too. But, it got to be so intense in the last 6 months. I really just sat in my chair, and I remain, for eating this way, you know, because I eat basically this high-fat, high-meat, lots of butter, and my only vegetable I eat are green beans, pretty much, in a lot of butter. And my health, my weight, I still felt good despite sitting in my chair all the time. So I know there's a line in epidemiology, the plural of anecdote is not data, But I've seen this. I hear a lot of people experience this, and I read this in studies too. So I'm glad you brought that out. Now, when we come back,
I just have to interject because our experiences are so parallel. And of course, again, it's the N equals one. We are a single data point. It means absolutely nothing. But for the last 8 or 9 months, I have done nothing but sit at my desk. I have barely exercised. I have, you know, the quintessence of the unhealthy life. But I didn't gain much weight. I am healthy. I had no colds. I've been healthy. I think there's no controlled experiment, but it surprised even me that that was the case.
Yeah, no colds here either, but also it helps when you don't leave the house. You're exposed to no one but your boyfriend, in my case. And actually, my experience does parallel yours. I went to Paris and ate for a week these things like you that I would never eat, foie gras. Everything had cream sauce, everything. You know, and I lost weight. I felt great. My skin, just everything was so good. It was just incredible. So anyway, when we come back, I want to talk about the origins of the hypothesis that saturated fat causes heart disease. But first, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is Nina Teicholz, and she's author of The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. And I have to say also, life is not worth living if you eat like Dean Ornish says. So, okay, I should ask you this question. I thought you might comment on that because I know that you probably feel the same. But on to what I said, the origins of the hypothesis that saturated fat causes heart disease. This was developed in the early 1950s by this biologist and pathologist at the University of Minnesota, Ansel Keys. So tell us about Keys and where he went wrong.
So Ansel Keys was a scientist in the starting out his work in the 1950s, which it's important to understand, this is a time in America the heart disease epidemic had really come out of nowhere and soared to be the number one killer. And there was a sense of desperation in the country that people really needed answers. And so they were open to all ideas. Keys came up with the idea that saturated fat was the villain. And he was this outsized character. He was incredibly charismatic. People would say that, you know, Ansel Keys would talk to you for 20 minutes. At the end of that, you believed anything he said. He was persuasive. He was called arrogant, even by his friends. He was this bombastic guy. And he took this hypothesis and was able to, I mean, he did a very big study called the Seven Country Study, which was like the big bang of nutrition science, where he went out and he surveyed people all over the world, well, in seven countries, almost 13,000 men, middle-aged men. And he discovered, he concluded that the saturated fat content of their diet was what most predicted their high cholesterol and their risk of a heart attack. So there are just, he went into this study already believing what the conclusion would be, and there were so many ways in which he slanted that study to get the conclusion that he wanted. Like, for example, he didn't include in his study any of the countries that he knew would contradict it, like France, you know, the country where, you know, with the French paradox, where people eat cream sauce on everything and their rates of heart disease are low. But not just France. I mean, Switzerland, West Germany, Sweden, there were a number of European countries that he systematically avoided and didn't include in his study. So it was not a random sample that he took. He also sampled, for instance, on the island of Crete, which was like his star data set, these Cretan islanders who, you know, hoed the fields and had long lives. He sampled them in one of the sample periods, one out of three, during Lent, when they were conscientiously avoiding animal foods. So he inevitably undercounted the amount of meat and cheese that they were eating. So there were all these problems with that early study. But nevertheless, it was the biggest study that had ever been published on nutrition when it came out. And he managed to, through sheer force of will and all this data that he now had behind him, he implanted his idea into the American Heart Association, and this was just key. The American Heart Association was the first organization. It was the premier group on heart disease, even back then in the 1960s, and it still is today. and their nutritional guidelines are considered like the gold standard. And he inserted his idea into the American Heart Association. It was like the DNA that informed the American Heart Association, and their first anti-saturated fat guidelines came out in 1961. And it's kind of like the rest is really history. It was a snowball effect after that. But that was the origin of where all our ideas about saturated fat came from.
And it's really terrible because we want to believe, I mean, they sound important, the American Heart Association. Don't they know better than the rest of us? We're writers and plumbers and, you know, bus drivers. You know, and what I see throughout your book so much is how much charisma affects believability. You write later in the book about Dr. Atkins, whose diet is, you know, is what you're talking about and what the evidence says is good science to eat this, you know, eat a diet that is not, that is, doesn't have carbs and that has meat and fat in it, you know, but Dr. Atkins is sort of a disagreeable guy. And so, you know, because he lacked people skills and also the research to back up his diet, he didn't catch on the way Keyes did, where Keyes had, I mean, his science is just, you show over and over in your book, The Big Fat Surprise, how Keyes, you know, it was just terrible what he did. One example you give, that he was first thrust into the spotlight when Eisenhower had a heart attack. So he was saying, fat makes people fat, this rich, fatty diet. And you note that Eisenhower, oops, also was a four-pack-a-day smoker. You know, it's so amazing. And you also bring out how these studies where people look at populations, and we talked about this on my show with Denise Minger, they're called cohort studies or epidemiological studies. I call cohort studies leaps to conclusions after the fact. And people just look at them and say, oh, these people died. Well, what else were they doing besides eating steak? You know, did they smoke? You know, what else were they doing? And you really, I mean, what I love about your book so much is that you really are very, very rigorous and look, this is bad science, this is good science, and here's why. And one of the things you mentioned is that how the recommendation came in for substituting saturated fats, which evidence shows now and even before are healthy for you, with polyunsaturated fats like corn or soybean oil, which are terrible for you. You know, the diet initially that Keyes recommended was relatively high in fat before it went to total low fat. So talk a little bit about that, about these saturated fats going to polyunsaturated fats and why that was a bad idea.
So when we were told to, when the American Heart Association told Americans to get rid of saturated fats, to cut them back, the question was, well, what do you eat instead? Now, what the American Heart Association recommended was polyunsaturated fats, which are vegetable oils like corn, soybean oil, peanut oil. These oils were invented in the early part of the 20th century. They were first introduced into the American diet in a hardened form, which was Crisco in 1911. And then they were introduced when they figured out how to make them more stable and not to oxidize so easily and not to give off flavors. They could introduce them as actual just oils themselves. And that was in the 1940s that you started to see bottles of soy oil and other oils on the shelf for salad dressings and cooking. And coincidentally, Procter & Gamble was also a sort of the transformative backer of the American Heart Association. The American Heart Association was this tiny, underfunded, going bankrupt little professional society of cardiologists up until the late 1940s. And then one year, Procter & Gamble said, you know, we'll make you the beneficiary of this show that we sponsor called The Walking Man Show and a radio show, and which Procter & Gamble sponsored. And overnight, the American Heart Association earned $1.7 million and was just at launch then. That's what transform them into the national organization with multi-chapters that they are today. And Procter & Gamble makes Crisco. And so there has been, from the start, this industrial backing of polyunsaturated fats, which really didn't exist before the early 20th century. And there is, you know, when you think about it in retrospect, how crazy that we thought we could restore our health by starting to eat these foods that had just been invented. Like, we'll restore ourselves to the health, like, before pre-heart disease epidemic by eating a bunch of foods that had just come onto their scene, really. But the main reason that polyunsaturated fats were, that we were told that they were good for health, is that they lowered total cholesterol, so compared to saturated fats. And later on, it was discovered that total cholesterol was not a good indicator for heart disease, actually. But, you know, by then, polyunsaturated, the idea that polyunsaturated fats were good for health had really become ingrained in the national consciousness. And they still lower cholesterol, but there are all these other issues with vegetable oils in terms of their health impact, other than cholesterol, that are worrisome.
I just want to get into one you talk about because this is something people really do not realize. I wanted to have you talk about oxidation. You know, if you go to a restaurant, chances are they're heating oil to a temperature that causes oxidation, and this is really bad for your health. So tell us what that is.
So vegetable oils they oxidize easily, especially at high heat and over prolonged periods of time. That means that they break down. They're all made up of, for the science nerds out there, they're all made out of carbon chains, and they take on extra hydrogens, and they change their shape and form, and they degrade into, like, literally hundreds of these oxidation products. Back in the 1940s, scientists who were studying heated oils, they found that they would shorten the lives of animals that they experimented on. They caused cirrhosis of the liver. They caused a bunch of nasty conditions related to inflammation. And those concerns were somewhat allayed when they figured out that if they just hydrogenated oils, that made them more stable. And hydrogenated oils are what became the backbone of the food industry. They're hard, so they're stable and long-lasting. They were used in basically all packaged foods. And that kind of became the most common fat that was used in all of our processed foods. And then we discovered that hydrogenated oils, one byproduct of that process was trans fat. And trans fats were found to raise cholesterol. So I don't know, that's a whole other shaggy dog story, but we decided to get rid of trans fats. The FDA decided that they would virtually ban trans fats, and all of the major restaurant chains, fast food chains across Idaho, shift to trans-free oils. One of the things that they do, the cheapest solution, are just regular vegetable oils, going back to those same oils that in the 1940s were causing cirrhosis of the liver in animal models. And in the last decade, a lot more research has been done on those toxic oxidation products, and they are still highly worrisome. That whole literature was not considered by the FDA when they made their decision to move towards banning trans fats. They literally just didn't even consider this aspect of vegetable oils. But it's extremely troubling. There are scientists out there who are worried about this and have tried to write about it and warn the public, but it's really an issue that has not risen to the surface yet.
Yeah, I've just seen some mentions of it, but it really hasn't, and it needs to. And so what would be healthier is what, lard, to cook in lard like we used to? Like, we used to make McDonald's fries in?
Well, you know, they used to make McDonald's fries in tallow.
In tallow, okay.
Yeah, I'd so love to taste tallow-fried French fries. I bet they're delicious. Yeah, they use a hard fat. You need a hard fat. Hard, solid fats are what is stable. These are saturated fats, butter, lard, tallow. Those are the fats that we've used for thousands of years. And one of the reasons that we use them, stable. They do not degrade. They don't oxidize at high temperatures. That's one of the reasons that people love coconut oil and butter, because they're high in saturated fats, and they do not oxidize at high temperatures.
So when we come back, I want to talk about some of the side effects of this advice, this non-science-based advice, like the Lipid Research Clinic study, which has some findings about depression. But first, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Nina Teicholz. She's author of The Big Fat Surprise, excellent book, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. So this is really shocking. There was this $150 million Lipid Research Clinic study, and they were surprised to find this, that men whose cholesterol had gone down were found to die at significantly higher rates from suicides, accidents, and homicides. And the authors of the study wondered whether this diet might cause depression. And remembering from your book, there was, I think, another study maybe in Europe that has similar findings. So this wasn't just an accident or an artifact of the research, perhaps.
There had actually been quite a few studies where the group that had the high vegetable oil cholesterol-lowering diet, it does lower cholesterol. It lowers, if you substitute all your saturated fats for unsaturated fats like soybean oil, you will lower your cholesterol by 12 or 13%. And that was shown in a number of large trials. The effects that they saw were worrisome, and they were worrisome at the time. This is in the 70s. In the 70s, they saw a number of experiments that had these results. One was the people on the soybean oil diet or the corn oil diet, their cancer rates were higher, significantly higher. They also died more frequently of violent and accidental deaths, which is this, you know, it's one of these categories that they check off for death, but it's bizarre. They could never explain it. And they were, the NIH was worried enough that in the early 1980s, they had a series of expert panels examine these issues and try to make sense of them. The people on those panels were all the familiar lipid hypothesis supporters, including Ansel Keys and his colleagues, and they concluded, we don't know what's causing this. Maybe, maybe people have cancer already, I don't want to go into all the explanation about it, but they couldn't figure it out, and they basically said it's still important to lower your cholesterol to fight heart disease, so we're going to brush these so-called side effects aside. Later on, the cancer effect is something that has never been explained, and the accidental suicide the violent deaths, it's possible that the research since then has shown that if you have depleted cholesterol in the brain or fatty acid imbalances in the brain needs cholesterol. It's an essential part of it's a part of how the brain can function. If you are depleted in that it leads to depression. And this has been, there's a number of quite a literature out there about this. And so that could possibly explain why they saw these results.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Also, I frankly find eating this way quite depressing, eating this sort of ascetic diet, which brings me actually to Nathan Pritikin and Dean Ornish. And Nathan Pritikin's dead, and so probably are many people. He had this horrible Pritikin bread and these other things, very ascetic diet. Dean Ornish also advocated horribly ascetic diet, very unhealthy. You write that he exiled red meat, liver, butter, cream, and egg yolks. These are all things we have found, the science says, good science says, are healthy. And what was amazing that you wrote about is that these things, red meat, liver, butter, these are even more forbidden on his food ladder than donuts, fried pastries, cakes, cookies, and pies.
Right, and the American Heart Association, they were also recommending bottled sodas, hard candy like gumdrops, in place of fatty foods up until not that long ago, like the early 2000s.
Yeah, it's so remarkable. And I know that when I used to eat this diet like you did, this very sort of ascetic, low-fat, count every calorie, oh my God, that has a half a calorie, don't eat it, that kind of diet, I was starving all the time. I was probably really angry all the time, you know, and at one point I just thought, you know what, okay, I'm a little rounder than some people. If anybody doesn't like it, screw them. And I used to go to Bubby's Diner. I didn't eat low carb then, but I just started getting a burrito, a regular burrito, chicken potato burrito, and a Coke, not a Diet Coke. And, you know, I actually, okay, the sugar is not so good, but this is this fatty, big, you know, satisfying thing. And I would just be able to go on that all day and not be this starving, angry person that I used to. And you look at these people, you know, that eat this way. This is a horrible way to eat. Not only does it make you fatter, it makes you bitchy.
I'm sure there will be people too that will attest to how bitchy I was when I was on a low fat diet. But I honestly don't know how people do it. I think they're incredibly disciplined to stay on a low fat diet and to count their calories. And I did it for years. And one of the things that happens when you're hungry, hunger is one of the worst experiences. It tortures people. And one of the things that happens when you're hungry is that people will reach for carbohydrate foods, you know, chips and cookies, and you're more inclined to reach for those foods, which are quick energy, when you're hungry. So those diets are like self-fulfilling prophecies of eating more carbohydrates. If you have a hamburger for lunch, you are not hungry. You don't snack. You don't have those urges to. I mean, the fat and the protein really fill you up. One of the great, wonderful things about eating a high-fat diet is you don't have to count your calories. As long as you're not eating carbohydrates, you just don't have to worry about gaining weight, and you don't have to worry about how many calories you eat. So it's just so liberating. I haven't obsessed about food in a decade now, and I forget how torturing that was, like what a vibe that held on my life.
Yeah, it was horrible. And also, Roy Baumeister writes about willpower. When you're hungry, when you're depleted in that way, you lose your cognitive ability. You lose your willpower. You know, and I'm the same way. I haven't counted a calorie. I don't know how long it's been. I just eat enough fat, and then I eat when I'm hungry, and I don't care if I'm hungry at 12 o'clock at night, I'll eat food. At any time, I eat cheese, I eat salami. I try to get food with as much fat in it as possible, which is hard because I live in L.A., you know, and like everything low fat, you know, count the calories. I'm the antithesis of that. I'm so much better off for it. And this is a thing that people don't realize, because we've been so brainwashed by all of this and vegetarianism, and even people having their children eat this way. You mentioned Jeff Volek at the end of your book. He's a dietary researcher, and he agreed with me on this radio show I did with him that it's basically child abuse to feed your children skim milk. This is like white water. Children need fat for their developing brains. They need cholesterol, and you're depriving your children of the nutrients they need to function in school and everywhere else.
You know, that's, I think, one of the most depressing sections of my book, which is the section on children. And it's so depressing to realize that children were roped into the low-fat diet, all children over the age of two. That began, the official government recommendation for that began in 1986, and the logic was, it's never too soon to start out a life in defense against heart disease. And what was good for the middle-aged male father in the household would probably be good, you know, as a population-wide exercise. If you reduce their cholesterol, you must, in the end, somehow be saving lives. And at that time, there were plenty of dissenters, especially pediatricians, who said, who's to say that the nutritional needs of children are the same as an octogenarian? Because, and it was the American Academy of Pediatrics back in the 80s who fiercely resisted this dietary guideline and refused to accept it. And the studies that had been done showed that children grow better and are healthier on a higher fat diet, at least 40% fat. And they would compare fat contents from even the fat of diets in different countries. If you get below 25% fat, you start to see growth failure. And the children who grew the best were the ones with 40% fat diet or higher. It's also true that when we adopted this recommendation for children in the 80s, there had been zero clinical trials done on children. And then they tried to play catch-up with the science, and they had a tiny number of trials on children, and they were irregular children. They weren't even representative of the mainstream population. They were children with exceptionally high LDL. They probably had some kind of genetic condition, which was not representative of the rest of the population. They found that when they put children on low-fat diets, and this was consistently found in all the studies, they did grow just as well. But what was not reported in any of the study conclusions is that they were at risk for nutritional deficiencies in
a huge number of vitamins and minerals. So the question is, why shift to a low-fat diet that's going to risk nutritional deficiency when a higher-fat diet does not?
It's just terrible.
And then you follow these children into adulthood. You know, they don't know. Were they able to reproduce? Were they able to? Maybe we don't know. Those studies were never done.
Yeah. Now, let me just ask you to talk more directly into your phone, and I want to point out something you said. You point out that a number of essential vitamins, including calcium and fat-soluble vitamins A, D, K, and E, can't be fully absorbed unless they're accompanied by fat. So this is so crazy,
right.
And I have to confess,
right.
My own Mother's Day, I'm a bad person, but she meant well. My mom, you know, she read Adele Davis and some stuff in Prevention Magazine. She sent my poor little sister to school with sandwiches made of Pritikin bread, green beans, and tomato paste, like
oh.
We were poor children. And my sister's really smart, but I think, you know, it's probably a wonder she graduated high school, because your brain needs more than this. Like you said, our brains, cholesterol helps them function. And it's just terrible, this experiment that's been done on kids. Oh, you know, it works for middle-aged men. Okay, let's give it to all the children, which is just crazy,
right.
And awful.
Right, and you know, the USDA for its Women and Infants Children Program, and also for the entire the school lunch program, they require 2% fat, milk, or less. And as you say, without the fat, you can't absorb the vitamins. Fat is the spoonful of medicine that makes the vitamins go down. So if you're having skim milk, you are unable to have those vitamins available, and without the fat, the calcium cannot be absorbed. It turns into calcium soap instead in the intestines. So the fat is what is needed to have full bioavailability. And you know, milk is like one of the perfect animal foods. It has fat and it has nutritious elements to it, and it's all together in one perfect package in the right proportions. So there's just, and non-fat milk is higher in sugar than whole fat milk or cream. So it just makes no sense.
Yeah, and that is, you reminded me, I want to move on because you said such great stuff in the latter end of the book on the Mediterranean diet and why saturated fat is good for you, and we'll come to those. But also you point out the Snackwell's phenomenon, as nutrition researchers called it, you know, how you can just mow through, you know, and are compelled to mow through a whole lot of this food that has a fat removed. They put in sugar, and, you know, recently Robert Lustig and others have noted that, look, sugar is really terrible for you. And you know, this is what got replaced when they took out the fat, because you have to give people something.
Right. So when you take fat out of foods, the fat plays a vital role. It provides texture and it provides taste. And food manufacturers, to replace that, they have to use what's called fat replacers. Those fat replacers are almost always carbohydrate-based. Sometimes they're just sugar. So low-fat foods are always higher in carbohydrates, and that's like this paradox of low-fat foods. And sugar is terrible for health. I think that now we're starting to see that, and there's a lot of research on that, there's this movie Fed Up that's coming out, and that's much more in the conversation now. But I think it's important to remember that the clinical trials that have been done do not separate out sugar, and they show that any kind of carbohydrate, a diet high in carbohydrates, period, is less healthy than a high-fat diet in the best and most well-controlled, rigorous clinical trials over the last decade.
Yeah, I think that is so important to point out. And when we come back, I want to talk about the Mediterranean diet, because it turns out some myths we believe in related to that. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Nina Teicholz. She's author of The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. So the Mediterranean diet, this diet of, you know, mostly veggies and fruits and grains, you can have some yogurt and nuts and eggs and, you know, cheese, but you're not supposed to have red meat, and you're not supposed to have milk ever. So this is very popular now, right? But and olive oil is supposed to be, now that became a part of this, and that's supposed to be this heart-healthy oil, but is it? Are there actually some problems with olive oil, which was, you say, sold to us the same way everything else was by these, you know, people with special interests?
Olive oil is such an interesting story, and, olive oil was not an ancient foodstuff. this is one of the incredible things in my research. When I was trying to research this quote about Homer, that he apparently called olive oil liquid gold, and it turns out olive oil was used to anoint the body. It was like a cosmetic, basically, to provide sheen to your muscles in athletic competitions and just for physical beauty. It was not a foodstuff. It wasn't a foodstuff until about 150 years ago in Greece and Italy and Spain. And the reason that we think olive oil is such a special heart-healthy fat to a campaign that was run by the International Olive Oil Council, which was an agency founded by the United Nations. Just its goal was to promote the olive oil industry. And that's the origin of everything that we think we know about the Mediterranean diet. The International Olive Oil Council sponsored an amazing series of scientific conferences all over the Mediterranean for scientists who were happy to, you know, go on these beautiful, sun-kissed spots, and join together for these really fantastic free vacations. And out of that came sort of the founding documents of the Mediterranean diet, which also had olive oil poured all over it. Walter Willett at the Harvard School of Public Health, who's the one who really introduced the Mediterranean diet to Americans, he said the Mediterranean pyramid is like the USDA pyramid with olive oil poured all over it. But olive oil has never, despite all the hype, there's never been the evidence. It's been reviewed even by people who research the Mediterranean diet have come out concluding that there has never been evidence to show that it has any special heart disease fighting powers. Amazingly, there's nothing special about it. It's a little bit more stable than other vegetable oils because it only has one double bond. It's called a monounsaturated fat, so it doesn't produce those oxidation products, so it's probably better for cooking. But there's nothing particularly special about it, which is shocking, really. I mean, it's been so promoted in the American press. There's so many cookbooks on it. And when I dive down into that literature, I just could hardly believe my eyes. So,
yeah, that is a huge revelation. I've seen some of the press about your book, and people need to mention this because so many people think that, oh, heart-healthy oil. And in fact, increasingly people are thinking that the evidence points to inflammation possibly causing heart disease. And what's really amazing, you write about this in the Big Fat Surprise, that the research about olive oil's anti-inflammatory effect, and the comment made by a critic that a person would have to consume more than 2 cups of olive oil a day to get the dose equal to that of an adult size dose of ibuprofen, which is remarkable.
Right. Well, you know, that was such an interesting study because that was the anti-inflammatory effect. That study came out in Nature. It's just this tiny little article. It wasn't even I think it was just like a commentary. It wasn't even a peer-reviewed study, but it came out relatively recent, a few years ago. People were desperate for some kind of proof to show that olive oil was actually heart healthy because there had been so little conclusive evidence to date. You know, you would think by, 2005, 2006 that would have been sewn up. I mean, the Mediterranean diet was presented to the American public as this special heart disease-sparing diet back in 1993. And, you know, by the way, there had been no clinical trials done on the diet when it was presented that way yet again. But even after a decade of research, nobody had been able to show anything particularly special about olive oil, and so there was still a need to fill that void of evidence, which wasn't really provided by its supposed anti-inflammatory effect either. But, you know, there was this kind of desperation in the field to find something.
Yeah, and you say that at one point in the book that doctors were compelled to say something, to do something. And what people don't know, they put so much trust in government and in doctors. And many doctors, they don't read studies except for, as you point out, the abstracts after they get out of medical school. And I find, luckily for me, I know enough about dietary science that I just use my doctor for tests, my primary care doctor. And, there are all sorts of things about healthy whole grains on the wall, you know, which, of course,
right.
You know, I had William, what's his last name, from he wrote Wheat Belly. shoot, I can't remember the last name.
Oh, Bill Davis.
No. Bill Davis, right, on my show, right. Who said there's no such thing as healthy whole grains. You know, and he's right, and I don't eat any carbohydrates like that, any starchy carbohydrates. I'm so much healthier. All my markers, I have the blood work of an elite Olympic athlete. You know, for a girl who sits in her chair, it's pretty good. Again, the plural of anecdote is not data, but this is so remarkable. People need to be, I think, you know, your book is so wonderful because you tell the history so interestingly. It's such a compelling book, but I hope, you know, besides all the dietary information and the dietary science, look, this is science, this isn't, what people get out of it is, look, be skeptical. You know, if you don't know about, if you don't know whether your doctor is good, look for other information, look for a few sources, because, you know, a lot of these doctors, a lot of these organizations that we think are so reliable are not. They're just people on a, you know, it's a PR game. And it's not, like you say, that there are no randomized controlled studies. No, I don't know if there are any studies, but those are the gold standard studies to support the, you know, eat olive oil. Everybody eat olive oil. Everybody change your diet. Everybody, you know, eat this way. It's such an abuse of the public.
Well, I think, you know, there's just a whole tiered series of things that happens. I mean, one of the things, what I try to do in my book is to explain how this happened. It seems like such an enormous mistake. How is it possible that all these really smart scientists could have collectively made this bad mistake? And so now we're faced with not being able to trust our nutrition authorities. And there are many reasons why that happened. One of them is, as you say, that people don't read anything other than the study summary. And so the early studies on saturated fat, for instance, they had all these problems with them. I mean, this is after that seven-country study I was talking about. They did all these clinical trials of saturated fat. You know, and some of them, they failed to control for smoking. That's huge. That kind of study couldn't be done today. Another study, the men in the study ate half the food outside of the hospital where the study was done. They had no idea what they were eating when they ate that other half of their food in the study. And at the time, in the 70s when these studies were done, there was a lot of criticism. There was a lot of debate going on in the scientific press. But then over time, we've lost the subtleties of our understanding about what the limitations were of those studies. So it's like a game of telephone where, you know, the first person says, oh, lowers rates of heart disease, but, you know, didn't control for smoking and failed to record the food of half the people in the study. And, you know, six people down the line, all you hear is lowered risk of heart disease. So, you know, that game of telephone is what has gone on in nutrition science. And, you know, that's just one of the many ways in which nutrition science doesn't function well. It's a hard science to do. And as a result, there's a lot of shortcuts that get taken or a lot of the soft data that comes out of kind of bad studies is used just as much as the harder data. And there's just, like, nutrition science just has a lot of difficulties to it that make it very hard. I mean, now 30, 40 years later, looking back on all these different studies, you know, it took me like 10 years of my life to go through all those studies and really try to understand this massive, voluminous, flawed set of studies, this huge amount of science, and separate the wheat from the chaff and really try to understand what had gone on.
See, and what I really respect about you is something I don't see that often. I see it in Big Fat Surprise. The journalists' reports of what the science says, they're even worse than the doctors who are sloppy and just read the abstracts. I have a guy who coaches me, an epidemiologist, and, you know, one of the things that he yells at me about is to look at the limitations. That you have to look for the limitations. That's what I look for in a study. I don't look for the good stuff. I look for the bad stuff. Where are the limitations? Sometimes I'll list them. Not always. You have to look for them. Sometimes you have to call someone up to do the math for you.
Right.
I pour over a stats book and I weep. But you know, most journalists who write about this stuff, you know, times are tough in journalism. So if you see something, for example, in the LA Times, which has the worst coverage, the worst science on health, they just move over their general interest reporters. Oh, you were reporting on politics yesterday. Now you're going to report on science. And you, like me, you're a person, you write journalism, but I've trained myself to read the stuff you have. Very few people have, and it's very important to look for people like you, like Gary Taubes, Michael Eads, who recommended your book to me, who I trust. These people, Denise Minger, who really lay out what's wrong with the study. They lay out, they explain it in plain language. They lay out the whole thing. It's not just, oh, this is good. Okay, here's the headline. And so we're getting close to the end of the show. I want to, very importantly, get into why saturated fat is good for you. You talk about Dr. Atkins, who basically was a disagreeable guy, and that's, you know, where Ansel Keys was Mr. PR, you know, and he wasn't even the first. Banting, William Banting, this London undertaker in 1863, figured out, gee, you know, if I don't eat bread, I won't be so corpulent. And so let's talk about that, how the body's fat secretion works.
Well, you know, I'm actually not a nutritionist, so I don't, you know, I don't know all the intricacies of, about how the whole metabolism work. What I can tell you is that the studies that really look at the best and most rigorous and most well-controlled studies of the last decade show that a higher fat diet leads to lower, leads to improved heart disease markers, improved markers for diabetes, and greater weight loss than a low-fat diet or even a Mediterranean diet. Now, exactly why that happens, I mean, one of the things that happens in a high-fat diet is that you're not eating as much carbohydrate. And carbohydrates, glucose, which is the breakdown product from starchy vegetables and also half of the sugar in table sugar, that will trigger the pancreas to secrete insulin, which is fantastically efficient at storing fat. It takes all the energy coming into your body and stores it as fat. And then the other sugar is fructose, which is, you see, mainly in fruit. That goes directly into the liver and really worsens all your markers for all your lipid markers, all your markers for heart disease. So those are some of the mechanisms that happen. The result is that the studies that really look at this show that higher fat diet is consistently amongst all kinds of populations that have now been studied very rigorously and in long-term clinical trials lasting up to 2 years. Those diets look healthier, just hands down. There's no question about it anymore.
Yeah, it's so incredible. And you write about, you actually are too modest. You lay this out wonderfully and very clearly. You talk about how if carbs are eaten throughout the day, insulin stays elevated in the bloodstream, and fat that remain, you know, it's in a state of constant lockdown. It accumulates, you know, it's stored, it's not burned. And so this is why, you know, you talk about this guy, you know, Dr. Eric Westman at Duke. He kept having patients run up to him and say, "Hey, doc, it's all I'm eating is steak and eggs. They're losing weight. They have improved cholesterol markers." So he has started conducting randomized controlled trials. They're finding exactly what you said. And one thing I want to bring out, too, you write about Jeff Volek and Stephen Finney. These are these two dietary researchers. They're also exercise buffs. And they found, actually, you know, there's this myth that an athlete needs carbs. And because people always, there's this period of getting off carbs that's sort of horrible. But they actually found that a low-carb diet actually seems better for athletes than this carb-loading diet.
Right. There's several things that are really interesting about that. I mean, Steve Finney, he started out doing this research in the 1980s at the University of Vermont, setting out to prove that carb-loading, you know, eating a lot of pasta before a big race day, was led to peak performance. And he found out the opposite. And he and Jeff Volek, they were not schooled in nutrition. They came up through alternative, different university departments, so they hadn't really been steeped in the diet heart hypothesis. So they were relatively like open-minded to ideas. Plus, they were both athletes. I mean, Volek was a state powerlifting champion. I might be getting that slightly wrong, but they were interested in peak performance. What leads to the greatest amount of muscle mass and the best performance as athletes? Jeff Volek is a kinesiologist.
And right, and I just want to add that Finney is a biker. So for you, you know, those of you out there, oh, he's just lifting weights. But Stephen Finney seriously bikes. So this is not a guy who's just sitting there picking up a big heavy thing.
Right, and they were really interested in fitness, and so they start. You know, there's in the fitness community, there's kind of this knowledge: if you eat a a low carbohydrate diet, you'll be better. You'll be a better athlete. You know, they're all eating those protein powders. So that was the beginning of their research. But they were really outsiders. They were not traditional nutrition researchers. I think that's the only way that they, that's the reason that they started this whole field of research. They really have done the pioneering research in this field. And, you know, surprise, their research has been largely ignored. And they don't get invited to scientific conferences, and they don't get their papers in prestigious journals. You know, until very recently, they've had almost no pickup whatsoever. So that's why you haven't heard about it.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. Now, we're out of time. I'd like to have you just finish up telling people what they should eat, if you can put that in brief, to be healthy, what the science says.
I think the main thing is to not be afraid to eat fats, not to be afraid or feel guilty about eating fat or saturated fat, and to have a diet that is fairly low in carbohydrates if you can, and to eat a diet that's high in fat, including animal fats, like meat, cheese, butter, whole milk, whole dairy.
I just want to add to that something Dr. Mary Dan Eads suggested about people changing their diets. What people can do, they can try that for 3 weeks. Commit to trying it for 3 weeks and see how you feel. And I think that you'll probably feel how I did when I went off carbs. Actually, first you feel like crap, so take aspirin. But it really is pretty incredible. If you give it 3 weeks or a month to try that and see, I think that that is very good advice. So we are out of time. I have been talking with Nina Teicholz. Her book, it's excellent, The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. Nina, thank you. This has been a really amazing show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.